You are listening to Fair Enough by Art Cologne and Texte zur Kunst. Your deep dive into the global art world. Thoughtful, intentional, and always ready to play.
Hello and welcome to Fair Enough, a podcast series by Art Cologne in collaboration with Texte zur Kunst. Fair Enough brings together artists, curators, writers, and thinkers to reflect on how art and its institutions are responding to the urgencies of our present moment. This season, marking the 35th anniversary of Texte zur Kunst, we're taking up the journal's motto for the year, "There is no art without criticism." Each episode returns to a past issue of the journal to revisit the debates it sparked and to consider how those questions continue to shape the cultural and political landscape today. My name is Michaela Dixon, and today we're joined by Professor Anna Kornbluh, who teaches English at the University of Illinois in Chicago. Broadly speaking, Kornbluh's research engages cultural production, including the novel, film, TV, art, and architecture, through and alongside Marxism, psychoanalysis, formalism, and literary theory. In 2025, she was ranked number 9 on the Art Review Power 100 list. Her recent essays have explored topics such as infrastructure cinema, the death drive, solidarity, and feminist abstraction. She is the author of Immediacy or the Style of Too Late Capitalism, published by Verso Books in 2024. Currently, Kornbluh is working on two forthcoming books. The first, Climate Counter Aesthetics, argues for forms that contest prevailing ecological artworks and counter eco-critical paradigms. And the second, Good Enough Art, offers a theory of mid-aesthetics in the context of disappearing middle-class economics, a topic we'll also be delving into in today's episodes. Thank you for joining us today, Anna.
Thank you so much for having me.
My first question is for listeners who might not be familiar with your book published in 2024, how would you briefly characterize the idea of immediacy?
Sure. So immediacy is a cultural style. And if you just take the word in itself, it's the negation of mediacy, mediation. So kind of middlingness and representation and relation and process. So I'm interested in this problem of intolerance for representation or a desire to cut out the middle, or also kind of cultural processes of cutting out the middle that leave us with this sort of whole ethos for cultural production of it is what it is, that we have kind of no words and, you know, no filter, and this kind of obsession with presence, as the kind of colloquial connotation of immediacy would suggest, right? And with spatial intimacy, but also with just experiential intensity and a kind of epistemic populism, the do your own research kind of, no, you know, that everything just springs or manifests, right? Hashtag manifest is dominant for a reason. And that all of this kind of in the realm of, as it were, metaphysics, like how we think about time and space and presence and knowledge and experience, is also accompanied by this aesthetics of apparency, where we have just a premium on authenticity and confessionalism and denuded language and kind of dissembled anti-fictional, anti-representational, anti-art in a lot of media. So that's the kind of category, is to try to name this style. And then broader work is to link that category to, you know, some kind of changes in what is specific in, as it were, the G7 economies, or the kind of sites of hegemonic and imperial cultural production in the 21st century.
Interesting. How did you, or when did you start working on the idea of immediacy, or how did you like come to, I guess we could say describe it in this way, but also come to see it as like a cultural style in particular? Was there a particular moment in which it became quite apparent to you, or in which you started working on it?
Yeah, so in the 2020s, there, and especially after about 2015, there was a lot of conversation about whether postmodernism had come to an end as a cultural style. Mm-hmm. Jameson himself said, and Frederick Jameson, who was the, you know, one who really proposed in a systematic way that postmodernism could describe culture sort of from the 70s, but certainly the late 70s onward, he said himself in 2016 that that was sort of no longer where we were. There were a number of efforts to sort of describe like what's post-postmodernism, what's after postmodernism, is there a new sincerity, is there something that counters the irony of postmodernism? A bunch of that kind of conversation was going on. And I like those conversations because I'm very interested in the questions of how cultural styles and cultural arts reflect history and historical changes and social and economic changes. And those are, as it were, Marxist questions about the articulation of the economy to ideology and to art. But I particularly started trying to pursue this framework for what might be different than postmodernism when I was noticing in the late 2010s that so much contemporary fiction was being written in the first person and was being written in a way that sort of eschewed plot and character and metaphor, and had this just kind of like immanentist way of kind of reducing the real formal components of the novel. And that to me, as a scholar of the history of the novel, this was really striking. Omniscience and third person is definitive for the English novel across 300 years of its history. And it's really cool because none of us get to think that way in our everyday lives, right? And so it's one of the magical things that offers us. And I was just so struck that fiction didn't want to do that anymore. And that at the same time as that was just sort of true across like award winners and really bestsellers and popular novels, that you just couldn't go to the bookstore and buy a book in the third person in English, that it was also the case that there was this, movement styling itself as avant-garde to be militantly anti-fictional. And that was much beloved by my fellow academics, the kind of auto-fictional movement, which has long history, but had a particular international blockbuster character in the late 2010s. And so I was kind of like, why is there this absolute animus to fiction that a lot of authors are articulating? And what is that, like aggression towards making and towards representation and towards the created and the not merely here? So then I tried to look for that kind of format of like keeping it real, cutting out the junk, getting down to business, like did that, and repenting and advocating a kind of militant rejection of the history of your forms and so on. Trying to look for that in other media to see if this was unique to fiction, because it was clear it was a mutation in the history of fiction and then it needed to be explained. But was that mutation something that was going on related to, say, the death of the novel, or was it related to some other, broader artistic imaginary of the time? So I started looking for what does it look like when, studio art or cinema or TV or other kind, architecture, when they are trying to negate themselves, when they're trying to take out the representational and formal aspects. And it looks different than in fiction in those other media. But when I started to realize that there were things that did look like, then I was like, well, wait, something is going on here across all of these different media, like at a whole scale, right? It's a whole vibe. And so how do you explain that? It's really a cultural mystery that there seemed to be this strange cohesive drive to immediacy, a demand on the part of cultural makers and cultural consumers. So then I wanted to find out about why.
It's super curious too, because this is sort of like a small part of maybe what we'll discuss also later. But it's interesting this shift between like the post-irony moment in postmodern, or this really ironic moment in postmodernism. And then nowadays, I mean, I don't know if I can, I don't know if it's perfect to characterize it like this, but I'd almost say for me, or this move to autofiction, which of course still has a relationship with the fictional or whatever, has some kind of connection to an idea of like I could call it earnestness or what was another word would be kind of like a quality that's genuine that people seem to also kind of be really attracted to because of what it seems to maybe suggest, and as you say, like quite a direct, immediate person to person kind of capacity.
And I think those are all values that people find compelling when they're reading stuff and watching stuff, and that seem to characterize what they're interested in their, in politics or in other kinds of relations, right? I mean, you hear our big news is the Mamdani election here, and it's like, oh, but he was authentic and he stood for something, and like, I do think that's super important in politics. But
Completely.
like, but where does this premium on directness and authenticity and cutting out the hard work and just having person to person instantaneous connection, where does that come from? And in the kind of Marxist tradition, we do tend to think that there are something like causes for cultural ideas, cultural ideologies, cultural styles, and that those causes are in the economic base. So, the big work of historicization and explanation that the book does is to think about why is instantaneity, person to person, on demand, like rapid transfer, why is that valuable now? And the answer is in secular stagnation, a crisis of production, and an overemphasis on circulation as a kind of other side of the capitalist matrix, and as the site where there's been an effort to squeeze profit because the G7s are at kind of industrial overcapacity, and they have not been growing. And that's not a Marxist point. That's like a Larry Summers, like standard economist point, that the rate of growth is totally slacking. And there's lots of indices of that in terms of stock market exchange transactions and stock buybacks and number of original companies launched and innovations and technology and so on, right? There's lots of ways to measure that. But this stagnation means that the things that have been the source of economic enthusiasm and profit in the 21st century have been all about directness, person to person, cutting out the middleman. It's called disintermediation. But, so gig economy, platform ecology, Airbnb, all these like informal but directly connected relations, and then also, just-in-time logistics and kind of same-day delivery and advances in high-frequency trading, a whole number of things that are based on this temporality of instantaneity and on-demand and fluidity and flexibility. And those economic structures, I really argue, are the kind of context in which we have to understand why it feels good to have like direct.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting point too to think about. We'll talk about art in a minute, but also like the relationship to media too. I think nowadays a lot about like this is a podcasting in general, this kind of like the, kind of unparalleled, I would call it, popularity of certain podcasts and how they have become also this engine for, yeah, I mean, news delivery too, and like information. And it's changing also like the political sphere, and it's in a way that is really unparalleled, and maybe we haven't seen it before, but it's interesting from my perspective too to think about how that's a consequence, as you say, of like economic structures. That these are yeah, they're not outside of the economy, even though we feel like there's some, maybe some people would characterize them as like corrections of a kind of status quo or a cultural moment, but it's really something also that's financial. It's kind of a curious point that I think is, from my perspective, that I don't hear that much about, basically, but I think is really interesting.
It's so interesting. I mean, I don't know how it is for you, but for me, as a very busy academic and public employee and parent, and I have a big job and a big life and so on, that podcasts are an optimizer for my domestic labor time, right? I can still be learning about the latest like cool sociology book that Daniel Denver has on the dig or whatever while I'm folding laundry and doing dishes. And it's part of that go, 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 like, optimization, extraction of value, everybody's overworking all the time thing. And we're trying to fight back from the leeching of overwork by trying to have pleasure in different spaces, right? And is it, do you like podcasting while you're commuting? When, what is the time that you're doing podcasting? It's also, I think, really important to think about in terms of the media ecology for podcasts, orality. And, we're living in a time where there is an incredible emphasis on the visual in terms of just scanning and, everybody has an image and vertical video and the delivery of content in that way. And it's really changing how we process information, and text may be, subsiding, and certainly the attack by the oligarchs on basic literacy with the AI grifter bubble is about, a kind of effort to move us into a different regime of the senses. Like that, instead of reading and instead of processing that way, that we scan and scroll and look, but also orality is a kind of interesting, complement and counter to that, right? That we might be doing a lot of listening instead of reading. And can we do that faster than reading or not? Or certainly we can do it while we're doing other activities in a way that's hard for reading. So just, what are the kind of incentives that we're given to enjoy certain media forms by their space in a broader business matrix where text is out and image and sense optimization is in.
It's certainly an interesting, I think, moment to be living in, and also kind of taking, I don't know, account of all of these different realities. While also, I mean, as a person now who is working in the visual arts, have been working in the visual arts for several years too, maybe one of the things that struck me, which I wanted to bring up in your book that I thought was super interesting as an example of immediacy, was this line in your book which says, it's almost as though from the perspective of an artist, I don't work in any medium, I just have a practice. One of the things I thought was super interesting about this is that, yeah, I guess in my own experience of like being very close with lots of working, living artists, lots of contemporary artists, yeah, lots of very young artists, but of all different ages, what you see, I would say, as a trend more broadly nowadays is to be an artist with just like one medium, I would say is actually quite rare, or seems like it's becoming a little
Exactly.
more rare. And then when that is the case, then the on the level of experimentation, there's something at the level of medium that's really curious to me in particular, because it's not just about what I would argue is like, pushing ideas through a medium or using a medium to kind of advance your ideas, but it's something a bit more, you could say tactile, or you could say a bit more textural or something. There's a different kind of experimentation going on there. But when you have kind of like the wide range of possibilities, so like drawing, but then painting and installation and video and performance, let's say too, plus text, is which we're also seeing a lot in the art world, artists that are writing their own text, or artists for whom like the text is now like an extension of the work. So it's not even a press release. It's just like it can be a kind of new autofiction. I think, wow, that's a really interesting change, or it's a development.
Absolutely. And that development is, fascinating and maybe pleasurable and intriguing and profitable for gallerists and for artists, but it does potentially need to be explained, right? So why is it that people are against medium? Why is it that they don't want to work in one medium? We think about the rigor of tradition and expertise and skill and being able to be really a master of something. And that's not appealing right now, or that's not a source of value right now. Instead, we have this notion that you have to bust out of medium, that you can't be contained, that you have to work in all these different dimensions, and that what the artist really is their practice, their charismatic, emanative, I am the work, right? The living, vital thing that can be performed. Every kind of communication is mine and is involved in my stylization and my presentation. That being in my presence is itself a work of art and so on, right? And that whole kind of constellation, again, have to be explained. And it really does seem to me consistent with this economic pressure to have things on demand, to have instant access, to have one day del same day delivery from Amazon, to have, and to feel oneself, oozing out of being uncontainable in any given, form, and to just have this spiritual, fluid, immanentist, vibrating, kind of energy. I think that that's very strange. And it's not unique to the art world.
No,
And
indeed.
it's a kind of metaphysical and political and ideological and economic, kind of predicament.
Have you had any, not just artists, but have you had any people who have reacted to this sentiment, or to you or in general, and how have those reactions been? I mean, it can be positive or negative, but I'm kind of curious about how people see maybe their own work, but also their own, yeah, on in a broader way, in let's say in light of this kind of statement.
I have been overwhelmed by the reaction from the art world. It's been pretty funny because I'm not primarily an art scholar, and there's not tons of analysis of art in the book. It opens and closes with,
Right.
people art, but in gallery art and museum sensations. I do write about and teach about art frequently, though, and I have gotten, just way too many invitations to come to studio MFAs and to talk to artists who are makers. And I get an email, every other day from some painter who's like, "You've explained why I don't sell my paintings," or "You've explained why I'm against what's going on," or "You've helped me
Wow.
think about, I was looking for a different way to work, and now I know I should do it differently." But there's also a lot of defensiveness, right? Because this whole ethos of I'm fluid and uncontainable and a radical practitioner, and everything I do is art, is very self-aggrandizing, and it is very consonant with the kind of destruction of the institutions that might support artists, whether that's accessible college education and even accessible graduate education, affordable, whether that is public funding for public arts projects or for even private arts projects. Whether that is the kinds of institutions that support aesthetic and cultural life, like libraries and museums and theaters and even third places, all these things kind of diminishing. And then all that's left is the just radiant self. And then you have to be your own marketer and your own manager and your own curator, and you're writing your own press release and your own wall copy. And like, and so they're doing the hustle. And the cult of the person is, the dominant formation of so much of that hustle, not just in art. It's totally true in, literature. It's totally true in just our hustle economy and our gig economy. Podcasts also about people, journalists not having venues to belong to because journalism has been destroyed as an industry, right? So, to just take another example. People are defensive, I think, and some people are mad at me, as they, should be, but I'm trying to provide context and explanation for why this feels like so meaningful or the only source of value or the thing they have to do.
Interesting. One of the things that in the lead up to this interview, I was watching another interview of yours, and one of the things that I was really that really struck me was when the interviewer said that you were a Victorianist by training. And I thought it's interesting because, I mean, I'm not a Victorianist in training, but I am and have been very close with people who are Victorianists in training. And one of the things that a lot of those people, and a lot of whom now have become academics, has taught me is also something very interesting about the movement between Victorian art and literature, and the modernist aesthetic, and how this shift, which I think, I mean, I could be wrong, but I think maybe it's not something that's actually so well understood and known, but how this shift, not that is responsible for how things are now, but it is quite modernism, from my understanding, is so much a kind of break from the Victorian era, not necessarily in not necessarily in exactly how the art was made, but really in thinking. And I think the way that this has been brought over, and even the fact that it was mentioned before, made me think a lot about how like the conceptual frameworks and the structures of thought are really changing dramatically in this period. And I wanted to bring it up because I kind of wondered from your perspective, how do you think this kind of shift and has sort of informed your own, I guess, approach towards like contemporary theory and aesthetics, if you think that it does.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, so I have a PhD in 19th century literature and culture. I also have a master's degree in film. I have always thought about different popular forms in capitalism, different bourgeois forms in capitalism, the relationship between the novel and popular film, for instance, the growth of photography, the advent of different kinds of popular aesthetic art forms, sculpture, painting, and so on, as they became marketized. So when you have a long view of cultural production, but nonetheless specific to the history of capitalism, right, and the history of imperial capitalism, that is something that can enable you to notice, for instance, the kind of cultural mutation I was talking about in the novel, right? Like, I was a person who always reads 19th century novels, always teaches 19th century novels, always writes about it. I have multiple books about 19th century novels, and it was just so staggering to me that nobody was writing a third person novel anymore. And I don't know that I was the only person that noticed that, but I definitely seem to have been somebody who diagnosed it. And then in the book, I actually get one of the biggest computational cultural analytics guys to run code to prove that this is, empirically the case in the history of the English novel and in the 21st century as a divergence, a dramatic change from that. So I think studying the 19th century can give you perspective on what's new and what's not new. And so that always kind of drives things. And if there's a way that I, sprang into this argument or fell into this argument by just noticing the weirdness of the first person, somebody who only works on contemporary literature might not have noticed that, or somebody who doesn't study older forms might not have noticed that, it's also true that as strange as Victorian sounds, and as much as you were saying, that so much Victorian aesthetic value and cultural value is overtly rejected in the, by the 1890s and in the kind of turn to all the things that we would call modernism, there is nonetheless so much that is still essentially Victorian about how we live in terms of the basic power structures, the basic ideologies and contradictions of liberalism and of empire, and the basic kind of financial capitalist system, because financialization really gets going in the 19th century. And that's what my first book is about, actually. And so there are all of these long form structures, long durée structures that really take shape in the 19th century that still profoundly orient our experience in our society today. I don't feel like I'm not a Victorianist when I'm thinking about, how does the platform economy shape original streaming content? Or, like, is there such a thing as a style of original streaming content? Because I am always thinking about what happens when you suddenly have a market for mass cultural objects, or when cultural forms are commodities, which is what happens in the 19th century for the first time.
It's really interesting to kind of like think about, I think, in this broader way, especially because I find, in our own relationship to art, immediate representational, even some historical art, there seems to be kind of a kind of interesting like look of certain things, I think, that are diagnosed as new. I mean, what I would almost say in contemporary nowadays, which is maybe because it has such a look to it that now it sort of has to kind of push past, I would almost say, this look of or aesthetic of what contemporary art looks like. And now you see not necessarily like a return to something, but there's also artists that we know that are working in like printmaking, and also where you have a flair of something that's also begins to look a bit more folkloristic, I would even call it, which I think is something that like for a long time is would look the has a quality that maybe wouldn't necessarily be called contemporary, or there's sort of different ways of thinking through or thinking beyond what is it to be like a contemporary artist. And I'm sure like it plagues many people every single day.
Absolutely.
But it also made me think about like, do you think, sorry to interrupt you, do you think that like immediacy could be seen as like a period of like as a moment of periodization after postmodernism in particular, or you think it's more, or how, yeah, I guess what's the difference for you between a period and a cultural style, or is that the same thing?
Right. No, that's such a good question. I mean, so just as you were saying that, artists might always be looking for ways to do things new and differently. And the make it new is the modernist imperative that has now been with us, for more than a century, right? So there's something old about it, right? That I think that it's definitely true that there are art styles and art traditions and even particular practices that have been with us since the beginning of time, despite there being interesting technological innovations. Immediacy was a worry and a demand of art in Plato's time. It's not like the desire for this or the concern about it is new. But to me, the thing that is new is the total coincidence between immediacy as aesthetic promise and aesthetic capacity with the system of economic value, this circulation forward, stagnating capitalism and all of its premiums on instantaneity and expressivity and fluidity. There's so much connection between the contemporary immediacy and that base. And ordinarily, we think about the disconnection between art and, the merely given world as like part of art's critical power. Like it's, estrangement and defamiliarization and innovation and invention and imagination, the novelty, that it's not just what's merely here. And so something seems weird to me or off about like that capacity of art to be new is like lost in the immediacy moment. But to get more specifically to your question, I definitely think that the style has a period. Like the style presents itself as if it's authentic, spontaneous, sort of charismatic and just sort of natural and just right, but I'm trying to provide a historical explanation and a historical set of causes for its emergence. And there are, kind of origin dates, as it were. And I don't think the period will last forever. I mean, the prevailing historical cultural sequence we might have, realism, modernism, postmodernism, if we think immediacy works as a name for the thing after postmodernism, there's a possibility that that sequence will last somewhere between 40 and 80 years, if that follows the kind of track of the other ones. But also, time itself is messed up for human beings right now because we have the total capitalist crisis fueled AI theft of creative production. The enclosure of all hitherto existing human cultural expression is being stolen and stolen for the explicit purpose of expelling the, cultural laborers, whether those are artists or teachers, videographers, drawers, anybody is supposed, we're just supposed to be cut out of the equation now, right? And we also are hurtling towards futurelessness in our, catastrophic incineration of the planet. So I don't know what humanity is going to look like in 80 years, and I don't know if there will be any space for making art. And it's really striking to me how consistently our regionally competitive authoritarian governments ascendant throughout the world are fundamentally attacking human creativity, fundamentally demolishing schools and libraries, and just trying to like murder our ability to make art. And I don't know what's going to happen as a result of that.
Yeah, it's certainly, I think, I haven't lived in the US personally, but I know very well of the situation in the UK when it comes to education. And it's a super complicated time. I mean, I was a Goldsmiths student not so long ago and experienced also like much of my education being tempered by strikes. But it's just kind of interesting, where, and you see this sort of, and in the UK, it also has a different kind of history, I would say, of course. Also, the labor force, et cetera, looks a particular way, and the slashing of pension plans, et cetera. It's a very dystopian period of time. And sometimes I think also when you work in the art world and you're also, working so much with artists and practice and ideas too, you can kind of be somehow like siloed from this sort of the fever dream in which everything else is operating, because, it's of course quite a niche operation. We also record this after the week of Art Basel, so some listeners will understand that this kind of, the and this week in general, like the date of recording is June 26th. It's a very particular political time as well. So it's really quite, it's to say also too, yeah, to kind of be kind of aware of this maybe more broader, yeah, socio-political, socio-economic, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, moment, which seems to be, yeah, kind of impenetrable, but also overwhelming in every domain, in every part of this, yeah, of course, also quite privileged world that we work in somehow.
I mean, the idea, especially after modernism, of art is that it is freedom and autonomy and that it can be indifferent to or against all of those terrible things. But the terrible things are so suffocating right now that I think it's harder and harder to imagine that art is a space of departure from that. Particularly because, just the opportunities for anybody to have basic literacy and basic acquaintance and familiarity with the history of human cultural production, like to have gone to free museums, to have looked at picture books when they were children. Like, you do actually need to know about what came before you in cultural production to be a good cultural maker. And the whole fictional, relational aesthetics, charismatic, genius, I can't be contained model is an obfuscation of that, right? It's like, oh no, I'm just manifesting. I'm just, singular, and nobody has been like me, and I can just do it by myself. It's like, no, you actually need institutions and education to make you an artist, to help you exercise your freedom. And those things are being, brutally assaulted.
Do you think in a way that this part of where we are at now is also kind of a response to, or kind of like a, I don't know, I keep thinking of a snowball effect, let's call it, from like the early stages of modernism. So sort of like the birth of the idea of the individual too, and like this way of thinking that's sort of, I mean, yeah, that's really related to kind of a subjective eye in the world. And do you think there's a relationship between those two things and kind of this, I mean, not necessarily this present crisis, but just like kind of where we're at now in general?
Yeah, I think that you can see that there's a certain extremization over time, right? So, some of the things that I think about in immediacy as opposite of postmodernism, you could also think about some of the other features as magnifications of them. And in the same way that postmodernism was magnification of modernism in a lot of ways. So, sure, the kind of modernist concern that, oh, realist novels are totalitarian, for instance, or like, or that there is no objective perspective. And so that, like, laboratory science and the omniscient narrator and the social realist tradition and painting, that they all have this fake, credulity about objectivity, and that it is subjectivity that is the truth. Yeah, that is still certainly echoed in these formations of charismatic personalism and auto fiction and auto theory, for sure.
So I think this maybe might be actually kind of a good moment, because I want to go back to talking about auto fiction, auto theory, but also as it pertains to the chapter in your book that's called Anti-Theory. This thing for me personally, I will say, was super interesting because I am a individual that comes from a liberal arts background. So I kind of came up at a time, and I was a person who was studying literature and critical theory at the University of Toronto. So my education between art history and literature and critical theory was like hand in hand. And this was a really formative moment and time of my life, and also has led me to where I am now. And I think so fondly about it, but one of the things that I was really interested about is also to think about how that also leads somebody like myself, like many of my peers, to a figure like Maggie Nelson in particular. And then one of the reasons I wanted to is to bring it up because I think you have quite an interesting take on this in particular, and how this kind of this form of, let's call it literature, you could call it, I guess would argue you would call it like anti-theory. Maggie Nelson, for those who don't know, is a very well-known author, artist, writer. She writes books like Bluets and The Argonauts that are, really big, humongous bestsellers in not even just in the United States, really across the globe, and have, I would argue, come to such, really came up at such an interesting moment in time too, because ended up really resonating with also individuals like myself, but also like so many others, because of the capacity to bring together experience, theory, also kind of like a crudeness, maybe you could say, like touching on topics that were like a bit taboo, a relationship to queerness, and this kind of, I mean, we could call it a perfect storm is the wrong word, but it was kind of a perfect vortex, I think, almost at the right time. And it landed in the laps of people like myself who didn't even think it was possible to write like that. And then there it was all of a sudden, and I can't remember, but and I remember amongst my peers too, having these very particular experiences of reading these things and almost thinking to yourself, oh, you could write like that, because at this time we're being trained, which is normal and also important, into writing essays, like academic essays at the university. But maybe for a question, I would say, like, how do you situate Nelson's work, I guess, within this move away from theory? And what do you think is like lost or even gained in this shift of the kind of, let's say, genre that her work represents?
Yeah, thank you for that. So it's very, beautiful and moving to hear you talk about what an effect that she had on you. And I think that's a great way to set up talking about it because she's outstandingly popular, right? And what I'm interested in is why, right? Because a Marxist cultural question is like the things that are resonant and commercially extremely successful are doing work of kind of dispelling, managing, moderating contradictions in our society. And I think that to me, the things that you describe as like emancipatory about her blurring together of different forms, and her what I consider, and I think she avows as her real contempt for the traditions that she is, kind of buggering, right? Is I think of it as much less her genius, spirited openness, and much more as the kind of way that this pressure on mediation and representation looks in the theoretical domain. And it is very much a product of the absolutely demolished conditions, working conditions for theorists in the US Academy and the changes in journalism. So this rise of hybrid essayistic writing, for instance, hyper related to, the personal essay is the genre of the internet because you don't have to invest in reporters, right? It's not deep background, it's not research, it's not investigation. And the kind of lyric genre busting personalism that she's the prophet of is very much the aesthetic face of what happens when, again, nobody thinks that they're going to emerge from college with the opportunity to have a journalism career or an academic career. They just think that they have to become an influencer, right? That they have to be the kind of charismatic, unbounded, that she presents herself as, right? And that this is what artistry is. And it's really just a reflection of our degraded conditions for cultural production. I think that it gets stylized as and sort of righteously edified as I am assaulting or demolishing or getting the better of, right, these manly traditions of thought, for instance. I think she extremely does not like philosophy and theory. I think she uses little tag words from philosophy and theory to kind of like give a little bit of frisson and pizzazz to her extremely graphic, self-disclosure. But it's an assault on the idea that we can produce knowledge and that that's real work that should happen in institutions that are funded and be published by university presses that are funded or considered and reviewed in public in newspapers that are run for by circulation and by subscription and not by impressions, and that have investment in their newsrooms and their editorial skills. So it's to me, it's just the idea also that somebody who has tenure at a university would think that what they need to be producing is stuff that's incredibly popular in the sense of not making scholarly knowledge or even kind of a particular genre of art or a particular medium of representation, but that is just widely available for uptake and sale in any way. That's also, again, a kind of index of these degraded conditions where it's like she doesn't think scholarly libraries would buy a book about Kant or, because one could write a scholarly book about the body and trans, for instance, right? But the library budgets have been redacted. So I just really try to think about, yes, people have this profound emotional response to this self-presentation as like the liberator, but there are working conditions that are the determinants of what kind of books professors read. And I'm not making some big study of Maggie Nelson, right? Like she's one example in a broader matrix of like a stupendous trend of the memoirization of academic writing and the memoirization of theory. And that's not just a sui generis or endogenous kind of development in epistemology about like what's the most important for knowledge. That is a reflection of the academic labor situation.
Yeah, it's interesting to me too, because now that you talk about it, we're thinking about it now. It also kind of maybe it's a push, maybe it's a connection to make that what I see too is that maybe it's an interesting idea to take, thought, theory, and also push it through your own personal experience. Like if there was a triangle of your personal experience and you push theory through it, then you have something that's kind of coming close to what not just her, but many people are doing now. And I think the idea kind of comes close to also what you describe as immediacy or something, because that everything kind of hits some personal, has to hit some particular touchstone which I would almost, I would argue there's no mediation for like yourself. I mean, you can be different kinds of ways with yourself, but it's an interesting kind of like practice of thinking about like art making in a broad sense, that you can push certain ideas through it, but like bounce it against your own personal experience. And then voila, there's your book, there's your art practice, there's your blah, blah, blah. Like these are kind of pieces, or these are ways that you are producing kinds of content, right? That are then like in the world in various formats. And that's the style somehow of immediacy. It's really interesting, I think.
Yeah, I like how you put all of that. And I think to me, it's like what comes out when you push it through, right? Because in the 1970s, we know the personal is political, or we know that there is feminist kind of life writing that counters objective history or masculinist philosophy or rationalist philosophy. We know that there is Latin American testimonial that counters official history, right? But all of that kind of stuff that's really the historical origin point for some of the things we might now call auto theory are ways of producing new official knowledge, right? Contributing to the general project of like, we need a better historical narrative of Guatemala, or we need a better account of the philosophy of science. And, and our personal embodied experience can contribute to enhancing that general knowledge. And I think that the vector, the direction of 21st century auto theory is exactly the opposite of that. And this is why I feel like there's this kind of bedazzling, or there's this taking of these things. The idea is, I need to manifest myself in my evanescent singularity and my, irreproachable, shimmering, distinction. And which is also my immediacy, right? Like nobody else can relate to it, because and that I can suck in these tools and traditions and tear them up for the purpose of, again, aggrandizing and beatifying, my distinct shimmering self. And then that what other people are supposed to do is not benefit from the knowledge that I have made, but go and make their own memoir. Go and write your own.
This I
Go and tell.
feel, yeah. This is an interesting point that you make, because this I feel it's an interesting product that it's not an ending actually at all. It's like a beginning. It's this kind of like generative format that seems to kind of like almost, yes, suggest to others that your version can be in existence too, and it can be the best thing that's ever happened. And that's just like a possibility that you have to come up with or live up to or produce somehow in the world. But
But that like iterative
yeah.
succession, and we talk about this in the chapter with regard to some other theorists too, very serious political theorists and so on, who also just say like everybody just has to, emanate themselves. That's exactly the demand of the data companies, that we all have, presence that is as rounded out as possible. So like this iteration without relation, is like that's the immediacy, are these little shimmering concretudes of the body that are, like unrelatable, and then everybody does their own in this atomistic way. Like the concern, and that again really does tie back to what the incentives are and what the sources of profit are in the platform capitalism.
What do you think the institution, let's call it, as a like the university, the institution, is to do, or what can they do in the face of the cultural style of immediacy, or do they want to do anything, or like how do you think what do you do, I guess, as a, I'm not
Oh
saying
my
that you represent the institution. That's a bit of a big question, but it's something that's kind of dawned on me now too, especially when we're talking about like knowledge production and the ways that it's in existence and the way that it's been changing too. It seems like a very existential moment, maybe.
Yeah. I think it's really important that the idea of the university, like the universitas and the general and the common, continue to be central to what's called general education. That there's so much university face of immediacy in the just turning knowledge into job skills and vocationalism, which of course there was like another article in Forbes today about how computer science majors, I'm sorry, it wasn't in Forbes, it was by David Perry and CNN, how computer science majors are like, tanking in the job market because they don't know anything except a specific amount of like code, right? And that can be not only potentially replicated by AI, but like people can be taught code if they know how to think, right? But they can't come up with interesting business concepts for like a new product that you need code for if they haven't study the history of human culture, right? And so, like, everybody shouldn't just only study code or only study engineering, right? They might need to know about the history of building and architecture and photography and forms in order to be good engineers, or the kind of true universitas of like the trivium and all the disciplines that we would, that original gen ed, like, meant that you had to take a wide breadth of kind of classes. I think that has to be upheld. And one of the things that we're seeing in massive kind of vocationalization, casualization, budget cuts, and so on, is an attack on the idea that university is about the whole person learning the whole kind of being exposed to the whole range of human epistemic endeavor so that they can choose which one they find the most compelling and stuff. But you have to have that diverse basis before you can then specialize. So I would like to see schools, commit to fair labor practices as far as their instructional budgets and lobby their, public funding authorities there, whether that's their states or their governments or so on, to make sure that there's access to education for everybody, because more people are in college than ever before. And when people want to go to college, and they, human beings are curious, right? But we have to have the institutional opportunity for that to really be about knowledge and about development and not just about specialization and credentialing.
It's fair. It's super interesting to hear your perspective on it. One of the things I wanted to do is also to ask you about one of your upcoming books that you're working on. The one that I thought maybe would be interesting for the audience is the one that's called Good Enough Art, which takes on the idea of mid-aesthetics in the absence of middle economies. How do you define mid-aesthetics? It's a quite a it's like it's buzzy somehow. Like it's very, yeah, it's curious.
So I'm so interested in why mid is an aesthetic judgment that is, super popular right now, right? Why do the kids say it? Why do our cultural critics arguing about it? There are, stories about it in, many kinds of magazines and journals. It's largely, an insult, but it's not totally an insult. And so, and the American Dialect Society put mid in its kind of American lexicon as a new word in 2023, but it's actually, as old as 880, and it's meant the same thing for all that time. So, why is there an urgency around figuring out what the mid is right now? And I think it's very related to the problem of immediacy, that if you cut out the middleman, if you cut out the middle, if you have these extremizations and these demediations, that there's a kind of loss of like what might be like middling forms. There's a loss of tradition, there's a loss of genre, because instead we have genre hybridity, like Maggie Nelson and like, Orange is a New Color, any kind of TV show, right? And so like, what is the middle ground is something that I'm very interested in, and I think a lot of people are interested in, but they mostly think that they're interested in rejecting it. And I'm trying to affirm it for all kinds of reasons. And so that's what the good enough is. But I'm trying to sort of think through, do we have monoculture, I think, and the monoculture immediacy style describes it in a lot of ways. Do we have tiers, as strata in the monoculture, or is there such a thing as like high culture, low culture, and some kind of middle brow moment, even if it's all in immediacy versions? Or do these stratifications disappear? And one of the things I've gone back to is a kind of cultural studies conversation about like what is the middle brow? And it has always, ever since Pierre Bourdieu wrote the first book about it, which was also his first book about art, his book about photography in 1965, the middle brow has never been a set of aesthetic operations or aesthetic principles or features. It's always been about what Bourdieu calls the sociological reduction, that it's what the middle class consumes and it is what the middle class uses to edify themselves. So we have every major academic study of middle brow, whether it's of music or cinema or literature, sort of goes with that reduction, where it's like, let me do an ethnography of these people. And there's not a lot of interest in a formalist description of the stuff. And because the presumption is it's not really a kind of style, right? And so one of the things I'm trying to do is say, well, if we have a historical situation where the middle class doesn't demographically exist anymore, right? We have extreme income polarization, extreme wealth inequality, a very growing lower class, a very growing upper class, and an emptying out of the middle. And we have a whole elaborate journalistic and sociological conversation about that, you know, that is related to the loss of institutions and the loss of democracy and the loss of unions and so on. But we don't have an art conversation about that. So if we don't have a middle class, you can't explain middle brow aesthetics by what the middle class consumes. So what could try to explain it by its stylistic features and its formal principles. And especially if we thought that that kind of artwork might do something good or something good enough, then like maybe we'd be interested in it. So I'm elaborating the what the aesthetic principles are of kind of the missing middle brow right now. And it's sort of a like, we should make art like this. It's fun.
Yeah, it's curious too because it's like it reminds me almost, correct me if I'm wrong. The one thing I think of too is art fair models, also ones that are like affordable art fair. For example, this seems to be kind of representative of this like middle zone because, of course, you have at certain levels like price points that are beyond like beyond middle class in general. So just out of reach. And I think from a class perspective, it produces something interesting because, as you say, you kind of are losing this moment, and it's almost maybe historically will like disappear completely from the map, which is kind of curious too, because I think, yeah, I mean, it also makes me think a bit of maybe this is a jump, but I also wonder whether it's sort of like mirrored in like the political zones too, like and how they work without a kind of central or centrist kind of figure as such. I mean, you can also map out different kind of political spectrums of different countries and make a different argument for that. But I would say in general, just this sort of idea of like, kind of a polar, yeah, these kind of these con a continuation of these polar spectrums all the time without kind of a, yeah, maybe the medium as you, or the mid, as you say, is kind of like the site of a lot of what, like kind of disdain is the wrong word, but kind of like no not influence, but no, I'm looking for a word that would be like excitement almost, like that there's no something going on. Yeah, there's no kind of like
There's no
passion,
Jews around it.
kind of, I guess, that it's just a bit like, yeah, that it's just mid, which is also very funny to think
But
about
like
that way
mid
now.
gives people a lot, you know, like perfectly fine TV or art that you can afford to put on your wall that you didn't buy at Walmart and also didn't buy at your gallery, right? But it makes your life better, right? And so just like what how can we think about those improvements, those pleasures, and you know, how it's obviously nobody who gets an MFA is like, I want to sell my photographs at my neighborhood fair to my neighborhood housewives. But why not? Because you could probably make a stable living doing that, and more likely than you would be like adopt, you know, have your photographs sold at like MoMA or whatever, right? So like, yeah, so I'm just trying to think about it a little bit. And as you say, like we have a vocabulary about political extremism, you know, authoritarianism and, you know, kind of violent populism and no kind of central functioning democracy or pluralism anymore, right? We have in kind of all kinds of infrastructural conversations about like, you know, the loss of the church and the loss of the public sphere and the loss of kind of social infrastructure, right? The loss of the Elks Lodge or whatever. But like, doesn't, you know, TV or fiction or photography like play a role in kind of holding society together and making ties and making connections? No artist would aspire to be like generic, but like there are some virtues of just generic and the good enough, you know. So I'm exploring
Yeah,
and trying to describe.
it reminds me of two things. One of them is this question of like art is as the ultimate unique object. It comes up a lot. And also the question on the opposite side of that too, which is becoming more popular, even like artist editions. It's kind of curious because I think it's almost a close, it's not a diss to say, it's the closest thing we come to also an idea of something that has like many iterations that then is kind of like popular in a way, but also has a different kind of your consumption capacity for this kind of thing is already much higher given the price point in general. But I still think it brings up like a really curious question around like, I don't know if it's just like individuality, but also really like the unique art object in particular, like that seems to be at the center of like this question of like value in particular all the time. And also it is how artworks become very expensive sometimes, not all the time.
Right. And so there's the absolutely unique, unreplicable thing that has the Benjaminian aura or whatever. And then there's the relational aesthetic side where there's like, there's no thing, there's only the ineffable experience. Right. And, but what is like in between those that is just sort of like approachable and there's a lot of it, it's replicable and like, but it does people good, you know? And again, that's not how artists, it's like all of our matrices of what's valuable in art, whether it's critics or art schools or galleries, you know, it's like they're modernists, right? It's formal innovation, it's, you know, irresolution and complexity of meaning, it is something we haven't seen before, right? But there are like more realism-pilled aesthetic values, like, you know, art forms that like teach us things or art forms that are solidly repeating a tradition, art forms that people know what to expect and they enjoy the thing getting what they know what they're expected. And you know, so genre, things like this are all stuff I'm kind of trying to work through.
Curious too, because I would say that nowadays it almost seems like it would be very radical to open up a kind of like, let's call it a shop instead of a gallery or something, where you have kind of like mid aesthetics that's really kind of widely available for, in a price point perspective, but also with artists who are thinking through those ideas. Somehow I think that would be kind of radical in some kind of perspective too, because it would really break with a lot of ideas of how a lot of these economies are structured today.
Absolutely.
Which is curious too to think about in the long run,
No, I know. First of all, I'm going to hire you to open the shop when my book comes out. But second of all, you know, like there's a, yeah, if you think about building economic society from the middle out, which is a kind of conversation some policy wonks have, like is very different than thinking about trickle down or even bottom up, right? But like, what if we were trying to produce culture in a generic and middling way so that people could enjoy it and have, you know, and it's like in a different, yeah, a different rubric. Yeah.
Would you call you because I m the one thing that just popped up in my head now was, do you think some people would call it like anti-intellectual? Maybe that's too dramatic, but do you think there would be this kind of
I think
assault or something?
that it's possible, like, you know, amateur, right?
Oh, no,
And non-innovation, right? Like, yeah, and the issue for me is partly the mismatch between stuff that actually does bring people in who are educated consumers, you know, bring them pleasure and routine pleasure and repeated pleasure and bring them edification and teach them things and improve their lives in different ways, the qualities of design that, you know, say architecture that. And like I'm writing about like the kind of buildings that get like smeared in N plus one as like gentrification gray, like the 5 over 1 that has like, but like you need dense housing. We have a terrible housing crisis, and that's a big factor in the l lack of the middle class, right? And so you kind of need these buildings that are gentrification gray, like, and when, because they're 5 over 1, they have like a kind of, you know, retail that's available that makes your life easy and contributes to more walkability of cities and stuff like that, you know. So we just have to shift our little value perspective a little bit.
I think it's also somehow I would almost I think somehow it's somehow generational in terms of how people are accepting it, you know, that like let's say there's the baby boomer generation, then I would be, I don't know, I'm the children of a baby boomer, that would make me Gen X or Gen Z, I don't know, but I'm
Well,
not
depends
the,
on the
I don't know which one is before Gen Alpha, not Gen Alpha, not the TikTok generation, but the one millennial. I think it's actually the difference between
millennial. Yes.
baby boomers and millennials. And somebody made such an interesting point where it was something like, you know, baby boomers have everything. They did like the best possible. And then something about how millennials want everything and they think it's still possible. There was this kind of idea that in like the millennial thinking, there's a way that there's a kind of the person positioned it a bit as a delusion, but that like we're still maybe because we're the children of people that economically, you know, compared to how we are will do did much better than us in general because of the conditions were different at the time and the capitalist boom was very intense, that we're kind of we've not given up on that dream of how life might look for us. So we think that in different ways of working, blah blah blah, that's still attainable. And I think it was an interesting, it's something that's been mulling, I've been mulling it over for some time now because I it was put in such a maybe an interesting way. And I think it also speaks to this somehow it also I find it has something, it speaks to this question of like mid-aesthetics too, because it's not so far from also these this question of like, yeah, how part how housing looks and like what you think is gentrification, what you think is low brow, high brow, how you want to live, et cetera, in this kind of constantly consuming era.
Yeah, I think that's it's very well said. You know, we're downwardly mobile. I mean, I'm not a millennial. I'm a little too old to be millennial, but you guys are downwardly mobile. And you know, I got one of the literally last tenure track jobs in 2008. You know, like you guys, you're downwardly mobile. How do you think about that? And how does that you know, change your orientation towards the n normative, normalcy, even like suburban stuff about like, do I want to own a home and how big should it be? And like, could I ever, you know, have, you know, two kids? Could I ever afford that? And, you know, what is a stable career, right? instead of just being a TikTok influencer or whatever.
Which sometimes, some days seems a bit tempting. You're like, maybe that's actually the way forward in life.
I mean, there's a lot of interesting, you know, studies about how few people are making money doing this, but nonetheless, everybody's trying to, you know.
Well, yeah, a lot of people are trying. And I think maybe, as you say, it's a bit more the illusion that there's a lot of money to be made somehow through like your own personal earnestness, character,
Exactly.
et cetera, where you can somehow like break through the mold of everybody else and be, yeah, deemed like the most perfect individual possible. My
Yeah.
last question for you is a bit of a zoom out, but I thought we'd end on kind of like a zoom out note. Do you think that art still has the capacity to imagine structural change, or do you think the horizon for like art and art production has changed amid the kind of current, let's say, yeah, the socioeconomic realities?
So yeah, the thing that is you know, kind of upsetting in immediacy is like that art is sort of renouncing its historical job of like being critical of the world, right? It's just hewing too close to what's here, and it's making a virtue out of that. It is kind of canceling its own imminently critical faculties and just iterating the values that we already have. And I don't think that that is the only possible way to produce culture right now. It's a dominant style, it's a hegemonic style, but there are residual styles and there are emergent styles. And I do really believe that art making is absolutely fundamental to the human. You know, it's unfashionable to talk about human beings, but I just think, you know, the oldest human cultural inscription are these abstract paintings, you know, not even the pedagogical animal paintings at Lascaux, but the much older ones that are just these like seven ochre lines on a wall. That, like, we have an inbuilt capacity for play and abstraction and representation for its own sake, for the means, you know, of just making. And I think that that will be stamped out of us by our o AI oligarch overlords and authoritarians who want to keep us in chains through violence. But I do th I think it is our intrinsic capacity. So I think there's a hunger for play and freedom and curiosity and beauty that is irrepressible, but that our conditions of education are making it really hard. And then our conditions of publication and art world galleries and all of that, making it really hard for people to succeed doing that work. And I don't just mean financially, but
Just in general.
yeah.
Well, on that note, thank you so much for your time and for joining us. This has been really a delightful conversation to have with you.
Oh, I agree. It's been so wonderful to have these thoughtful questions from you. Thanks for reading the book and taking the time.
Of course. Thanks so much. And you're maybe before we leave it, when should we expect your Good Enough Art will be published?
That's a hard question.
Okay.
I hope in 2026, but I'm not quite done with it yet, so we'll see how much more I get done. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much again.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Fair Enough by Art Cologne and Texter zur Kunst, where ideas travel and perspectives expand. From the world's first art fair to today's conversations on modern and contemporary art. The dialogue continues every fall live in Cologne. For more information, visit artcologne.com.